This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Black Privilege. Opportunity comes to those who create it. Written and read by Charlemagne the God.
This book is dedicated to the state that made me great, South Carolina. The 843, the 803, and the 864. To every dreamer living on a dirt road somewhere, this book is for you. In my story, may you find the inspiration to create your own greatness. This book is also dedicated to my mother, Julie, my father, Larry, and my late grandmother, Rosalie Ford. The foundation of who I am came from the three of you. I don't know if y'all even want to take credit for my madness, but guess what? You have no other choice. Last but certainly not least, this book is dedicated to my rib, my wife, Mook Mook, and our two beautiful daughters, A and Z. Yes, the name of one of my daughters starts with an A and the other starts with a Z. We will fill in the rest of the alphabet at a later date. Please, when you two are old enough to read this book, don't judge your father for the sins of his past. I used to be a young savage, but I'm grown now, and I hope this book will remind you that life is about constant evolution. Introduction. Let me tell you about the first time I started living my truth. I was 15 years old and living in Mount's Corner, South Carolina. If you're not familiar with Mount's Corner, it's a small town of less than 8,000 people, about 30 miles north of Charleston. For most of my teenage years, my family lived in a double-wide trailer on a dirt road on the edge of town. My mother was a high school English teacher and a Jehovah's Witness, a straight-laced woman who did everything by the book. My father was her polar opposite. A contractor who was an occasional drug and alcohol abuser and a full-time hustler. One of my favorite activities back then was to talk on the phone. Not a cell phone either, but an old-fashioned landline. If you think sexting is better than talking, you don't know what you're missing. I can honestly say that 90% of the times I got pussy as a teenager was because of phone conversations, especially the late-night ones. My trouble started one night when I was on the phone with my friend Amani. By the way, names have been changed to protect the guilty, the easily embarrassed, and those who want to come up by suing me. I don't think I ever wanted to fuck Amani. Not that I would have turned it down if the opportunity presented itself, but we would just talk on the phone for hours for no reason. That night, the conversation turned to a guy we knew named Darnell, who was Amani's cousin, Deja's baby daddy. "Man, Darnell thinks he's hard," I offered. "Oh, you think he's soft, drawled Amani?" "Maybe he is, maybe he isn't," I continued. "All I know is my father always tells me the dudes who act hard in this town all end up one of three ways. Broke sitting under a tree, in jail, or dead." After that, the convo probably turned to something more pressing, like who was the best member of the Wu-Tang Clan. Neither of us gave my little rant about Darnell any more thought. A few days later, after smoking weed, I decided to go visit my neighbor Charles, who lived at the top of our dirt road. Charles wasn't home, but as I was walking out of his yard, Darnell and his cousin came driving by. They spotted me and quickly pulled over, skidding to a stop in a cloud of dust and pebbles. "Yo, Larry, what's good?" Darnell yelled menacingly as he hopped out of the car. Leonard is my government name, but people in Mount's Corner call me Larry after my father. I had zero idea what Darnell was yelling about. Number one, I was high. Number two, I talked shit about everyone in those days. I must have had a quizzical look on my face because Darnell quickly filled me in. "You was talking that shit to Amani," he announced. "So we got to fight." I'd said what I said, so there was no need to cop a plea. "Yeah, what about it?" I answered back defiantly. But Darnell was already done talking. He unleashed a wild roundhouse that would have knocked my head off, but thankfully missed. I managed to land a quick jab in retaliation. It seemed like he barely felt it. Despite being basically the same size as me, in one quick move, Darnell scooped me up, lifted me over his head, and viciously pile-drived me into a ditch. If someone had taped it, we could easily get 20 million views on Worldstar with that footage today. I tried to get up, but Darnell was already beating me back down. Punch after punch after punch after punch. Then he moved on to a chokehold. Now, in my experience, there are two kinds of chokeholds. One, the "I'm just letting you know things can get real, so don't play with me again" type. And two, the "this situation is so real that I'm going to choke you until you die" type. I'm pretty sure option number two was being administered to me in that moment. Thankfully, his cousin stepped in before Darnell could finish the job. Chill, man. That's enough, he said, pulling Darnell off me. Let the dude go. Darnell relaxed his grip, and I could breathe again. Though I'm sure there are some folks today, Bow Wow, Sierra, and Birdman, to name but a few, who would pay good money to go back in time and tell Darnell, nah, choke him a little longer. Think I'm exaggerating when I say Darnell was trying to kill me? Well, several years later, Darnell did kill my cousin's mother by putting her in one of his chokeholds and snapping her neck. He's serving a life sentence for it today. At the time, of course, I didn't know I'd been in the grasp of a killer. I was more concerned that I looked like I'd just gotten into a head-on collision with a Prius. I didn't want anyone to see me with my face bruised up. So once Darnell and his cousin drove off, instead of going home, I limped across the road and crawled into a vacant trailer we used to live in. Sitting on the floor with all the shades pulled dark, I started crying. Ashamed that I'd been beaten so badly. Not to mention afraid of what my father would say when he saw me. Get the fuck out of here, he told me after I tried telling him someone accidentally slammed the door in my face. You think I'm stupid? Once I got over the shock of what had happened, I started feeling better. After a while, my tears even turned into laughter. How could I not laugh at myself? I looked like Martin after he tried to box Thomas Hitman Hearns. I literally had a knot on my head so big a doctor would eventually have to shave it off. I was happy because I sensed that I'd entered a new stage in my relationship with the truth. Most people would have walked away from a beating like that thinking, I really got to start watching what I say. I had the opposite reaction. If I just survived that, there was no way I was censoring myself at all. One of my favorite songs at the time was Notorious B.I.G.'s Unbelievable, where he rapped, if I said it, I meant it, bite my tongue for no one. Sitting there in the trailer, I could hear Biggie's lyrics over and over again in my head. And his words, I'd found my own voice, too. Bite my tongue for no one was the mantra I was going to live by. If I had something to say, I was going to say it. If someone wanted to know what I'd said about them, I'd tell them to their face. What's the worst that could happen? I'd get beat up. I just survived a 5-star ass kicking. If that was the worst that could happen, I was all right with it. By the way, do you know they let prisoners on Facebook now? I didn't. And the other day, I got a friend request from Darnell. When I saw his face pop up on my screen, I immediately thought, no, he's out? And almost had a heart attack. When someone beats you like that, you never get over it. Bite my tongue for no one. Throughout my years as a radio guy, first on local stations in South Carolina, later as a co-host on Wendy Williams' show, then as the host of my own show in Philly, and eventually as part of The Breakfast Club, the syndicated radio show I host on New York City's Power 105.1 with DJ Envy and Angela Yee, I've been asked, not to mention threatened, to watch what I say more times than I can remember. I've been hated on for my honesty, fired for my honesty, even punched in the side of my head for my honesty. But I've never for a second doubted that honesty is not only my best friend, but also my secret weapon. Almost 20 years later, my tongue remains unbitten. Perhaps the best example of the depth of my commitment to honesty is the first time I interviewed Kanye West on The Breakfast Club. To give you a little context, the interview happened while he was out on tour supporting his Yeezus album, which I thought wasn't up to his usual standards. To make matters worse, Kanye had been delivering long rants about how the fashion industry wasn't giving him a fair shot, how he was a genius, but no one in power in the industry understood his vision, how he felt like a slave to major corporations. In my eyes, instead of trying to keep up with the Kardashians and worrying about whether an editor at Vogue liked his blouses, Kanye should have just focused on what made us love him in the first place, compelling, heartfelt music. I knew that as long as he was connected to the people via his music, all his other dreams and aspirations would eventually fall into place. In order to get him back on track, at the end of the day, I am a Kanye fan and want him to succeed. I started calling him Kanye Kardashian to poke fun at his new image. I also named him Donkey of the Day several times, a daily feature on The Breakfast Club where I give someone the credit they deserve for being stupid. Of course, when word got out that Kanye was coming in for an interview, the question on everyone's lips was, will Charlamagne really call him Kanye Kardashian to his face? Will he tell him Yeezus was whack? That's certainly what Natina and Amin, Kanye's rep from Def Jam Recordings, was worried about when she arrived at our studio the morning of his interview. Charlamagne, whatever you do, she implored, please don't call him Kanye Kardashian. You got to understand why that's not cool. Being the pain in the ass that I am, I crushed that dream right away. Since you asked me not to say that, that's the first thing I'm going to say, I told her. Though in truth, I was always going to say it regardless. I added that little dig because I really hate when publicists and label reps ask me not to do my job. I'm here for the listeners, not the artists, and certainly not the labels. If there's something I feel listeners would want me to bring up, then that's what I'm going to do. Here's a little Radio 101. Listener benefit trumps everything else. True to my word, as soon as the interview began, I got right into it. They said it would never happen. A repeat donkey of the day offender, I said, as Kanye smiled uncomfortably. Kanye Kardashian. I wasn't done. As soon as the talk turned to Yeezus, I was truthful with Kanye. I didn't like that album at all. And I was a Kanye West fan, I told him. But Yeezus was whack to me. Was I being a bit of an asshole by calling Yeezus trash or by introducing him as Kanye Kardashian? Of course. But Kanye's a certified asshole himself, and he respected my honesty. Despite the rocky start, we ended up having a great conversation. The interview created so much heat that I ended up getting profiled in Rolling Stone and in New York Times. That's a lot of attention for an ex-felon from Monk's Corner with a night school diploma. And while I appreciated that people found the Kanye conversation compelling, the fact is, mainstream America was just learning what people who had been listening to me for years already knew. Every interview I do or conversation I have is rooted in honesty. Whether on the radio, on my podcast, or on TV, I'm always going to be honest. Honest about myself, honest about my opinions, honest with whomever I'm talking to. That commitment to honesty was one of my main motivations to write this book. I've lived a great life thus far and enjoyed every step of the process, the highs and the lows. I don't like to label those experiences good or bad because they're all part of one lifelong process. I've learned something from each and every one of them. I've been a bully and been bullied. I've been a drug dealer, a so-called thug, a so-called nerd. I've been to jail a few times. I've come within inches on more than one occasion of fulfilling my father's prediction for Donnell and all the other knuckleheads in our town. Broke under a tree, dead in the ground, or rotten in jail. But despite all that, to quote the great Pastor Young, a.k.a. the rapper Jeezy, here I stand, a grown-ass man. Yes, that little boy on the dirt roads in Monk's Corner, South Carolina, is a grown-ass man now and has managed to realize all the dreams I had for myself. My goal for this book is to pass along the valuable principles I've absorbed through living what I feel has been an eventful life. Some of the principles I've developed on my own, others have been passed down to me by the wise elders I've been fortunate to meet. Despite having a big-ass mouth, I pride myself on having big-ass ears, too. I'm a great listener. Regardless of their origin, I'm hopeful no matter what your background or situation, you'll find value in all of these. Here's some of the principles that you're about to learn in this book. Success isn't determined by the size of the town you're from or what sort of home you grew up in. When I first started doing radio in NYC, people tried to make me ashamed of coming from a place where you pull over when you see roadkill. Pro tip, if it's cold, you leave it there. If it's warm, it's dinner. But even if Mouse Corner was a small town, it had a magic in the air. Magic that I was able to harness and motivate myself with. There's something special wherever you come from, too. Find it and use it to help it propel you towards your pursuit of greatness. Here's another principle. In order to change your life for the better, first you must change your lifestyle, which can't happen unless you change the people around you. My family didn't have much, but I still got off to a good start in life, wearing glasses and a fanny pack, reading Judy Blume books, and hanging out with nerdy white kids. Then I made the mistake of ditching all that for my cool cousins who were thugging. A note on the term cousin. I'm going to be using it in the Southern sense. A cousin refers not only to blood relatives, but a lot of other folks, too. Truth is, I still don't fully understand who my true cousins are. It's very confusing when you don't know which of your cousins are actually related to you, not to mention very awkward after you've had sex with a couple of them. I had one foot under that tree my father always told me about, one foot in jail, and let's call it my dick, a.k.a. my third leg in the grave. Thankfully, I woke up and realized I had to cut all the losers loose, even the blood relatives, if I was ever going to reach my potential. I hope this section will help you see that no one is a victim of circumstance in life. No matter how or where you were raised, you can make the choice to live a different way. Often the most valuable advice you can give someone is fuck your dreams. Sounds like pretty depressing advice, but it comes with a qualifier. Fuck your dreams when they aren't actually yours. For young African Americans, relatable images of success are often limited to sports and entertainment. Too many times the dreams you think are yours are actually someone else's. You're only chasing them because you've seen them working for others. I should know. I wanted to be a rapper because that's what I saw young black men who were successful do. Thankfully, someone who could see I didn't have the skill set to be an MC had the courage to tell me, fuck your dreams of being a rapper. It turned out to be the single best piece of career advice I ever received. This is why I often say, if you don't have anything nice to say to anyone, say it anyway. Also, as someone who has been fired countless times, I can promise you there are no losses in life, only lessons. From getting let go from Taco Bell by my own sister, no less, to getting canned from Wendy Williams' show, to every single time I've been fired, a short time later, I've always landed in a better position. As long as you don't compromise who you are, no matter how many pink slips you get, there's always going to be something better out there for you. Learn how to trust what I call divine misdirection. when you're starting off in your chosen field. Just focus on putting the weed in the bag. If you don't know classic hip-hop cinema, I'll explain that quote in greater detail later. But now, just know it speaks to the importance of embracing the process instead of what may seem to be the results. Too many people, especially millennials, lack the vision to recognize opportunity when there's not a paycheck attached to it. Always live your truth. When you live your truth, can't nobody try to use that truth against you. For instance, do I look like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle? Of course I do. By embracing my egg-shaped dome, I've taken all the ammunition away from people who call me the fifth Ninja Turtle or a burnt Ninja Turtle. By laughing at those comments instead of getting uptight, I replaced the perceived weakness with power. You might not look like a Ninja Turtle yourself, unless your name is Neo, but chances are there's something you're uptight or embarrassed about that you could actually turn into a positive by just embracing the truth about yourself. Always give people the credit they deserve for being stupid, starting with yourself. I walk through life assuming that I've got a lot to learn, and I happily soak up any knowledge that comes my way. Too many people take the opposite approach and decide they've got it all figured out by the time they're 25. That's a mindset that is guaranteed to block your blessings. You must stay open to new ideas, to new kinds of people to work with, to new mentors who can coach you. Otherwise, you are going to always be stuck in place. Finally, embrace the concept that you are privileged. I believe in the power and privilege of God, and God created me exactly how He wanted me to be and who He wanted me to be. I believe I'm just as privileged, if not more, as any white person out there. I have to believe that. Otherwise, I'd never have transcended the circumstances I was born into. No matter what your circumstance in life, you must adopt the same attitude. You must believe strongly that you've got Latino privilege, Asian privilege, tall guy privilege, smart girl privilege, whatever your particular situation may be. And then you've got to have complete faith in your privilege. This book is only for those who believe that they can create their own opportunity. I need to share these principles in a book because I know just how much power the written word holds. Plus, it didn't hurt that the publisher wrote me a nice size check. Remember, I'm the son of an English teacher. From an early age, my mother kept a book in my face. Those books combined with her love are what nourished my imagination and inspired me to transcend my circumstances. Books are what provided me with a sense of escape when the tension between my parents made our home feel suffocating. Books helped give me the confidence to dream bigger than I was supposed to as a poor black boy growing up in the rural South. Books are where I got the name Charlemagne, even if I did misspell it. My life is a living testament to the transformative power of books. Having said that, as you might have noticed, the language in this book is going to be raw. I'm raw on the radio. I'm raw on social media. I'm really raw on podcasts. And I'm not going to change up now just because I'm an author. That means jokes, most of them tasteless, will be made at people's expense, including my own. It also means some of the topics I touch on might make you uncomfortable, especially realities that many in America would prefer to sweep under the rug. Realities that are inevitable when cycles of poverty and neglect are repeated year after year, generation after generation. I'd say sorry in advance, but the truth is, I don't give a fuck. If you're looking for a book that sugarcoats situations and runs from reality, then you're in the wrong place. If you're wondering how uplifting principles could come out of a potty mouth like mine, it's simple. I'm a firm believer in the concept of ratchetness and righteousness. By that, I mean embracing the full spectrum of the human experience includes both ignorant and inspiring moments. Far from being mutually exclusive, they're the yin and yang of a fully lived life. So enjoy the ratchet moments and get inspired by the righteous ones. Remember, shit is the best fertilizer. It's what helps the flowers grow. Finally, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about all the famous rappers I've broken bread with or bragging about every beautiful woman I've talked into my bed. Yes, I've been very fortunate to meet a lot of the artists who inspired me growing up. Yes, I've had sex with more beautiful women than anyone who looks like me has any reasonable right to, but I've got bigger fish to fry. I want to show you how opportunity truly does come to those who create it. I want to tell you about the people I grew up with in Mount's Corner, how I learned the right way to live from my father's words, just as how I learned not to get down from many of his actions. I want to speak to you about the village that raised me and how so many of the mistakes I made could have been avoided if I'd listened to my elders. I want to tell you how the spiritual legacy of the African slaves can still be felt in South Carolina 400 years later. You're going to hear about UFOs behind my grandmother's house, tales of my crazy cousins, the dudes I slung crack with, the teachers at my high school who we tortured, and the guys I got locked up with, including my pops. The colorful cast of characters that made this rural southern town feel like the center of the world to me. Because ultimately, those people and experiences, much more so than any celebrities I've met in New York or Los Angeles, represent who I am, what I could have been, and what I've become. I went from Mount's Corner to Madison Square Garden, all on MTV, telling them how I sold D. There really is a Jay-Z bar for every situation. From reading liners on a 50,000 watt station in South Carolina to hosting the biggest nationally syndicated hip-hop radio show, actually one of the biggest radio shows in the country, period, which just happens to be rooted in hip-hop. From not even being registered to vote to actually interviewing presidential candidates and having them vie for my endorsement. If you've ever wondered whether you can change your trajectory in life, I'm here to tell you that you can. While everyone's paths are different, have confidence that no matter your situation or your perceived stature in our society, your truth is more than enough to take you where you want to go. Black privilege. Principle one, it's not the size of the pond, but the hustle and the fish. Geographical location doesn't determine what kind of success you will have, but your psychological position always will. How are you going to make waves in a bigger pond when you haven't even learned how to cause a ripple in the pond you're in? When you stop complaining about where you are physically and start focusing on where you are mentally, that's when you will start to transcend your circumstances. The origins of the dirt road dirtbag. I was born in Charleston, South Carolina, one of the oldest cities in the nation. For a long time, it was also one of the richest, thanks to being the center of trade for several industries, including deerskin, indigo, cotton, rice, and most lucratively, African slaves. Sullivan's Island, which lies in Charleston's harbor on the Atlantic Ocean, is where hundreds of thousands of African men, women, and children were brought to this country in chains during the Middle Passage. If you're African American, there's an almost 50% chance one of your ancestors landed at Sullivan's Island. Despite having so much historical significance, you won't find any Statue of Liberty-sized monument commemorating what scholars call the Ellis Island of slavery. Nope, all you will find is a couple of plaques and a memorial bench Toni Morrison arranged to have built overlooking the ocean. Chances are you've never heard about any of that. This is why, as Public Enemy once rapped, history shouldn't be a mystery. Our story's real history, not his story. Specifically, Sullivan's Island is where most of the peoples of West Africa were brought to America. It's probably safe to say I'm descended from one of them. I went to a family reunion a few years back and heard some relatives say that the McKelveys, that's my father's last name, have Irish ancestors, but it's more likely we just had Irish owners. I did some research when I started working on this book and found that there had been a lot of slave owners in the area with my last name. If you look at some of the old records, you'll find actual sales receipts like this one from 1805. McKelvey, David de Ebenezer Hopkins, bill of sale for a slave named Ben, a barber by trade. Maybe Ben the barber was one of my ancestors. Probably the most famous former slave to live in Charleston was Denmark Vesey. Denmark was born on St. Thomas in the Caribbean in 1767 and ended up being sold to a ship captain who brought him to Charleston. After some time in the city, he won $2,500 in a lottery and was able to buy his freedom. He stayed in Charleston and co-founded the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in an effort to aid the slaves in the area. After doing all he could for the slaves through his church, Denmark decided that working with local white leaders wasn't getting him anywhere. So in 1822, he started secretly organizing a slave revolt in Charleston and the surrounding area. The plan was that, on an assigned date, all the slaves in the area would rise up, overwhelm their masters, and then march to the port in Charleston. From there, they'd sail to freedom in Haiti, which had recently won its independence from France. The plan might have worked, except that Denmark and his fellow leaders got dimed out by a local slave. Now that's snitching. And everyone was arrested before the revolt could happen. After a short trial, Denmark and 30 other slaves were hanged. I've always found Denmark incredibly inspirational because he didn't have to help the other slaves around Charleston. He not only literally won the lottery, but he was also a skilled carpenter and could read, which was a rarity back then. It had to be tempting to say, "Peace, Charleston," and carve out a nice life for himself up north. But he didn't go that route. He was committed to his community and ultimately gave his life trying to liberate it. Unfortunately, if the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston sounds familiar to you, it's probably not because of Denmark Vesey. No, the church Denmark helped found over 200 years ago to help slaves is also where the terrorist Dylann Roof killed 9 innocent black folk back in 2015. So clearly, the more times change, the more they stay the same in Charleston. This is why we need to celebrate heroes like Denmark Vesey whenever we get the chance, instead of letting them become a footnote to history. I wouldn't even feel right putting my name on this book if it didn't tell his story. Another thing you should know about Charleston is that it's a center of Geechee culture. Geechees, or Gullahs as they're also called, are the descendants of slaves who lived along the Atlantic coast in the Lowcountry regions of South Carolina and Georgia. Even though they've been in America for hundreds of years, Geechees still have a very close connection to African cultures and languages. I've met Geechees who speak a dialect that's closer to African languages than English. Clarence Thomas comes from a family like that and claims one of the reasons he never talks in the Supreme Court is because he grew up ashamed of his heavy Geechee accent. Other kids would make so much fun of him that he became more comfortable listening than talking. Or at least that's his story. Chris Rock, Michelle Obama, and Trick Daddy all have Geechee roots as well. Even if you've never heard of Geechee before this book, you've probably heard some Geechee phrases like Gruber, a.k.a. Peanut, and Kumbaya, which means come by here. Growing up in Charleston, I wasn't aware of all that history yet. I do remember going on a field trip to the Charleston Museum, which is actually the oldest museum in the country, but only because I pushed open an emergency door on purpose and set off a fire alarm. Even as a little kid, I was always a bit of an instigator. Our family, including my older sister Teresa and my younger brother Julian, lived in a trailer park in the North Charleston neighborhood. The trailers were packed tight together. If you stepped into your backyard, you were also stepping into someone's front yard. One reason I never minded the close proximity was there were two girls in the trailer behind us who would flash me whenever they saw me looking out my window. Even though I lived there the first 7 or 8 years of my life, my memories of Charleston are pretty scattered. However, I can distinctly remember that my father had a stationary bike behind our trailer that our neighbors would come over and ride. They'd pedal on it for a couple minutes. That's what passes for going to the gym in the trailer park. Then they'd hang out and drink beer with my pops, just shooting the shit. White neighbors, black neighbors, it didn't matter. The sort of solidarity Dylann Roof was trying to rip apart. The dirt road less traveled. When I was about to enter the second grade, we moved to Monk's Corner, which is where most of my people are from. My maternal grandmother lived on Route 17A in Monk's Corner, while my father's folks are from Kitfield, which was just down the road. Since we spent so much time in the area visiting family, my parents already owned a little piece of land off a dirt road on the edge of town. Eventually, it just made sense to move our trailer over there rather than stay in Charleston. Even though it is only about a half-hour drive from Charleston to Monk's Corner, culturally, they are two very different places. Monk's Corner doesn't have any of the history, sophistication, or energy of a city like Charleston, or any city for that matter. Put it this way. Think of a place like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, or Atlanta, full of restaurants, stores, infrastructure, opportunity, and access. Then picture the exact opposite of that. A place with no opportunity, no access, no infrastructure, no stores or restaurants. The place you're picturing is Monk's Corner. Okay, I'm exaggerating slightly about the stores and restaurants. Monk's Corner has plenty of barbershops, a lot of them black-owned, banks, and grocery shops, as well as a McDonald's, a Sonic, a Chick-fil-A, just got that in the past couple years, though, a Wendy's, and of course, the holy grounds that are Walmart. The downtown also has a courthouse, a detention center, the depot for the train to Charleston, a YMCA, and Berkeley High School, which was my alma mater, even though I got thrown out. Over by the old Santee Canal Park is the Berkeley County Museum and Heritage Center, a little building that has memorabilia from some of the local plantations, as well as dinosaur bones that were found in the area. That might not sound so bad, but trust me, there really isn't much to do. After a day or two visiting Monk's Corner, you'd be ready to get back on the road. Having said that, there were great aspects to growing up in Monk's Corner, the best being the relationship it helped me develop with the outdoors. Almost as soon as I moved in, I started playing in the woods with the other kids in my neighborhood. Any day we didn't have school, we'd be up at 8 and out the door by 9, exploring every part of the country we could. The woods that bordered Monk's Corner were filled with otters, beavers, coyotes, bobcats, raccoons, and deer. We'd also visit the swamps and rivers that were home to gators. We were never too scared of gators, but we were always on the lookout for the snakes that seemed to be hiding under every rock and fallen tree trunk. Cottonmouths, copperheads, diamondback rattlesnakes, and timber rattlesnakes are all native to the area. One time we biked down our road and found our neighbor, Mr. Wilson, standing over a diamondback rattler he just killed that was literally 10 feet long. He chopped off his head and was pouring gasoline over his body because, as he explained, you gotta kill the devil. You see, the country people, a snake represents Lucifer in the flesh, so you don't play around with them. Another time, my mother drove me and my friends over to Kitfield because my father wanted to show us something special. When we got there, we found him with a huge rattler he just killed. "This is why I tell y'all stay out of those damn woods," he yelled, shaking his limp body at us, "because this is what's waiting for y'all in there." My father didn't like us roaming the woods, but ultimately, the only rule we had to follow was to be back home before dusk. That's the universal law of the hood, urban or rural. Get your ass inside before the streetlights come on. There weren't any neighborhoods where we were afraid to go. As we saw it, all of Monk's Corner was our turf. People tend to think of the South as heavily segregated, but race never felt like a big issue in Monk's Corner. When we moved to the trailer park, there were 5 other black families living on our road. The Trotters, the Wheelers, the Presidents, the Gibbs, and the Wilsons. Over time, a few white families moved in and a Mexican family as well. When those white and Mexican families arrived, it wasn't an issue. They were just there. My parents might have experienced racism in their day, but my friends and I didn't feel it as kids. There's a neighborhood called Pinopolis just north of Mount's Corner, and that's where I imagined all the rich white people lived. But I never did bother to go over there. Looking back on it, all the homes I'd imagined as mansions were probably regular as hell anyways. I didn't go sightseeing in Pinopolis because I've never felt envious of what other people have. Most folks I knew lived in trailers, and that felt regular to me. An African-American family named Gibbs did have a brick home down the road with a formal den and a nice-sized kitchen, plus a big basketball court outside. As a kid, that was the most immaculate house I'd ever seen. When I did dream of something better than what we had, that's all I saw. A nice little two-story brick home with a basketball court. The supernormal. Snakes and gators weren't the only creatures that roamed Mount's Corner. Plenty of supernatural creatures abounded as well. Or as I prefer to describe them, supernormal. Because to me, there's never been anything out of the ordinary about encountering the spiritual realm. My first encounter with the supernormal came when I was 5 or 6 years old, with one of my favorite toys, a little plastic tractor with a farmer sitting on top of it. Suddenly, that plastic farmer hopped off the tractor, walked over, and started messing with me. Not in a threatening way, but almost more as if he was issuing me a warning, as if he were telling me, hey, you're not alone in this universe. I can get off this tractor if I want to. Every few days, that farmer would mess with me. I even told my mother about it, but she just blew me off with, well, you don't say, and then went back to whatever she was doing. One day we had a trash fire going. Yes, it was so rural where I grew up, you had to burn your own trash because the county wouldn't pick it up. When the toy farmer drove his tractor over to me again and started acting up, I'd had enough. So I grabbed it and threw it into the fire. Let me tell you, that little farmer began screaming for his life as the plastic began to melt. I should have rescued him, but I was too freaked out to move. My next encounter came when I was in third grade. The bus used to drop me off at my grandmother's after school, even though it would often be several hours before she'd make it back home from her job in the school cafeteria. One of my favorite ways to pass the time was to hang out in the huge field behind her house. I'd stand out there by myself and act like I was putting on a rock and roll concert for an imaginary audience. This was before I discovered hip-hop, so I was really into being a rock star. I'd play air guitar and pretend I was Michael J. Fox riding on top of that van in Teen Wolf. One day I was in the middle of a mean guitar solo when a black flying saucer suddenly appeared above the trees that lined the yard. It looked exactly like the generic flying saucer that you would always see on TV and in movies. A black disc with a little round bump coming out of the top. The saucer hovered over the trees for a moment without making any noise. Then just as suddenly as it appeared, it zipped off and was gone. I'd never seen a flying saucer before, but I wasn't scared. Why should I have been? People are afraid of what they don't understand, but even at that early age, I was already fully aware that non-human life existed in the universe. If anything, seeing the saucer was just another confirmation of what I'd already known. Another supernormal presence in my life has been hags, who are a major part of Southern African-American folklore. Hags are female spirits or witches who come into your bedroom while you're asleep and sit on your chest until right before dawn. They don't like sunlight. When they've got you, you literally can't move. Some doctors try to call this condition sleep paralysis, but in South Carolina, we know better. It just means you got a visit from the hag. Almost everyone I know in South Carolina has had the hags come to them at least once or twice. Some folks try to keep them out by sprinkling salt by their doors because it's said a hag will try to pick up every grain and run out of time before the sun comes up. Another trick is to leave a straw broom by the door because a hag will get distracted trying to count all the straws. Growing up, there was an old lady in my neighborhood who used to catch hags. She never told me how she did it, but when I asked her what they looked like, she said they were small, shadowy figures that had the shape of a woman's body. I didn't totally believe her until the hags finally came for me one night when I was a teenager. I woke up out of a deep sleep to see a little shadowy bitch doing a dance on my chest. I tried to brush her off, but I couldn't move a muscle. Then out of the corner of my eye, I saw three more little female shadows waiting for their turn to jump on me. Over the course of what seemed like hours, they all took turns giving me lap dances on my chest until they finally split right before dawn. It truly felt like I'd had a train run on me by a bunch of hags. Some of you are probably thinking, Charlemagne, would you please stop it with these hags and UFOs? No one believes in this shit. Well, to that I'd like to say, number one, I don't care if you believe me. I experienced all of these encounters, plus a few more, so I don't need anyone's validation. Besides, why would I lie and open myself up to ridicule for no reason? Second, a lot of people do believe in the sort of paranormal activity I'm describing. not only because they've experienced it themselves, but also because hags and other supernormal beings are directly rooted in the cultures the slaves brought to this country hundreds of years ago. In many parts of West Africa, there's nothing strange about being visited by hags, just as there's nothing strange about the concept of talking to your dead ancestors. For generations and generations, the West Africans I'm descended from have believed that there's no separation between the spiritual realm and our day-to-day lives. Growing up in Mount's Corner, it wasn't unusual to hear adults talking about communicating with the dead. I can often remember my grandmother mentioning that she'd spoken to my dead grandfather in a dream. "Yes, he came to me last night and warned me someone might die today," she might say, "so I want you to be extra careful today." Talk like that felt normal. It even felt comfortable. I liked knowing that the spirits of my ancestors were out there looking out for me, sending me advice through dreams and visions. Julie and Larry's son. As a kid, you can get so focused on your parents being your providers that it's easy to forget that they had a life before you were born. I've noticed the same dynamic with my eldest daughter, who has never asked many questions about my past. The other day, I casually mentioned something that happened while I was in jail, and her jaw dropped. "What?" she blurted out. "You went to jail?" For a second, you could see her thinking, "I don't know who this guy is, because my daddy would never do anything that would land him in jail." I can't lie. I like that the idea of me being locked up was mind-blowing to her, but also made a mental note that it was time to start teaching our family history, the so-called good and the so-called bad. As to my own parents, I do know that my mother, Julianne Ford, is a beautiful woman, physically, mentally, and spiritually. She was born and raised in the Mount's Corner area. Her father died before I was born, so I don't know much about him. My grandmother, Rosalie Ford, was a lunch lady in our school district for many years. My mom grew up with a sister and a brother, though he sadly drowned when he was around 17. After high school, my mother attended South Carolina State University, an HBCU in Orangeburg, which is roughly 45 minutes farther inland past Mount's Corner. After graduating, she started working as an English teacher in Charleston, where she somehow got caught up with a character named Larry McKelvey, a.k.a. my pops. They got married and had a daughter, my older sister Teresa. After Teresa, there was a miscarriage, and then came me, followed by my younger brothers Julian, BJ, and then my sister Ashley. At some point, my father also had my half-sisters Tara and Sarah, but we didn't know about them until after my parents split up. Like I mentioned, my mother is a Jehovah's Witness. She doesn't drink or smoke or carry on, but she married my pop, so there had to be an adventurous streak in there somewhere. My first glimpse of it came one day when I was over at my grandmother's house looking at an old picture of my mother, my Aunt Lo, and some other folks. After glancing at the picture, my grandmother threw some shade in my mother's way, saying, my, look how short Julie's dress is compared to everyone else's. When she said that, it hit me. My man and mother must have had a wild side when she was young. As for my father, there was never any question about his wild side. He stands about 5'5", and like a lot of little dudes with big personalities, was constantly living life to the fullest. Everyone in Mount's Corner knew my father as Cowboy. They called him that because he is a rabid Dallas Cowboy fan. So much that he has 6-time Super Bowl champion Dallas Cowboys tattooed on his arm. Mind you, as I'm reading this, they've actually only won 5. He figured he could speak, or in this case, draw that 6th ring into existence. But we're still waiting. Once, my mother bought me a Washington Redskins sweatshirt after they won the Super Bowl. When my father came home and saw I had a sweatshirt from the Cowboys' most hated rivals, he took it out in the front yard and treated it like my plastic tractor, threw it in the fire. My father didn't love the Cowboys because he was from Dallas or even Texas. Nope, his people had been in South Carolina for as long as anyone could remember. He loved the Cowboys because during the 70s, they were winners and had the pretty cheerleaders. They were America's team. My father was drawn to that energy. When Jay-Z was on The Breakfast Club, he told me that his father had a similar attraction to the boys. "It's really my pop's fault," he said, after I asked him why he repped the Cowboys instead of the Giants or the Jets like everyone else from Brooklyn. My father grew up in that whole era, those guys who wanted that cowboy lifestyle, all those guys doing coke, you know? "My pops was definitely on coke," I laughed. "I got the whole thing pegged," said Jay. "I can give you the whole profile. He have an afro?" He absolutely had an afro. "I know he was a Cowboy fan," said Jay. It was true. For a certain kind of black guy in the 70s, the Cowboys represented a dream they were chasing. It's no surprise my father was attracted to their flashy image. He always prides himself on being the best-dressed person around, even though he usually looks country as hell. Just to give you an idea, he wore an all-red leather outfit, shirt, jacket, pants, shoes, and hat last time he took his wife out for Valentine's Day. Imagine what a pimp would look like in a small town in South Carolina. What you're seeing is my pops. Dressed like a fool or not, Around Mount's Corner, my father was undisputedly the man. Everyone loved Mac, another one of his nicknames, short for McKelvey. If my dad was on the scene, that meant things were popping. During the 80s and 90s, he ran a bunch of nightclubs, including one called The Zebra. When R&B artists like Clarence Carter, Tyrone Davis, or Millie Jackson came through town, they would often play a set at The Zebra. The legendary George Clinton even made an appearance one time. I bet my father paid him in coke. My father would make a point to show the artists a good time while they were in town. To this day, he claims he sniffed coke with Rick James and Tina Marie. He's probably lying, but since neither of them are here to dispute it, we'll let him have that. When he wasn't throwing concerts at The Zebra, my father was working several other jobs. For a while, he had a fish market on Main Street called Max Seafood. I used to work there when I was little, sweeping up, helping customers, and putting stuff back on the shelves at the end of the day. His steadiest job, legally at least, was working as a contractor. He was great with his hands and could build houses from the ground up. His dream was to build homes in the area and then flip them for profit. But he struggled with drugs and alcohol, which tripped him up before he could get his construction empire off the ground. In a word, my father was a hustler. If you needed anything at Mount's Corner, you saw Larry McKelvey. Some shrimp for a fish fry, see Larry. A waitressing job at one of his clubs, see Larry. New roof on your house, see Larry. A little coke for the weekend, see Larry for that too. My father was a big talker, but he could always back it up. For the most part, I never saw him get into any real beef, but I do remember one night my father walked briskly into the trailer and whispered something into my mother's ear. All I could make out was, we tied him up. Next thing I know, my father is on the phone trying to explain to some guys why they can't find their friend. Turns out my father had gotten into a fist fight with him. A dude as big as motherfucking Hulk Hogan, as he later described it. Because my father was outsized, he hit the guy with the brass knuckles he always carried and knocked him out. My father didn't know what to do with his knocked out foe, so he tied him up, drove to our trailer, and called the guy's friends to explain what happened. They must have come and picked him up peacefully because I never heard about the guy again. It was because of that situation that I started carrying a set of brass knuckles myself. Old habits die hard, and I'm still known to have a pair on me from time to time. While it was cool to have a father who was the street mayor of our town, a lot of pressure came with it. Everywhere I went, I'd inevitably hear, "There go Cowboy son." You can't have much anonymity in a small town where your dad has one of the biggest personalities, especially as his oldest son. It's hard to play the background when your father is always lit. Of course, playing the background is what a kid, even one with a big mouth like mine, often wants to do. Many times I felt my father was friends with everyone in Mount's Corner except for yours truly. Growing up, I always wanted him to be my buddy because that was his relationship with my cousins who were around the same age as me. With them, my father was the big homie. A steady stream of advice, belly laughs, and backslaps. With me, he was more serious. Instead of laughs and backslaps, I got lectured and slapped upside my head. Looking back, I could see he was tough on me because he didn't want me to make the same mistakes that he had. So even though I wanted my pops to be one of the homies, he knew he wasn't here for that. He was here to be my father, and that's exactly what I needed. Transcend your circumstances. It ain't where you from, it's where you at. Eric B. and Rakim, I know you got soul. When the god Rakim first spit those legendary bars, most people assumed he was speaking on physical locations. It didn't matter if you were from the Bronx or Brooklyn, the suburbs or the streets. If you were down with hip-hop, then in Rakim's eyes, you were good. There's tremendous value in that message. Yet as I grew to appreciate the song over the years, I realized there were layers to Rakim's lyrics. He wasn't only speaking about locations on a map, but a state of mind, too. In other words, the place where you were born or the circumstances you were born into don't have to define you. You can be born in Mount's Corner, but have a New York City mindset. You can grow up in a housing project in Chicago or a trailer park in Louisiana and still have the mentality of someone who was raised in L.A. I'm speaking here to all the people, especially young ones, who feel trapped by their circumstances, who feel they must move to an Atlanta or New York or Los Angeles in order to prosper. Ultimately, you might have to make that move. I did. But before you do, you must focus on where your mentality is, where you're at. Too many people who grow up in a proverbial small pond fall into the trap of believing that they'll never achieve success where they're at. As a result, they end up settling. What's the matter that I dropped out of high school? There are no good jobs around here anyway, they'll rationalize. So what, I got a baby before I got a degree, they'll say. It's not like my mother went to college either. I understand how easy it can be to sink into that mindset. I doubt most people reading this book grew up in a time where the prospects of making it seemed any more daunting. If you were lucky in Mount's Corner like my mother-in-law, Miss Patty, you could get a job at the Gates Factory, which made timing belts for cars before it closed in 2008. It employed maybe a couple hundred people. Or you could work for Berkeley County like my mother did. After that, the next biggest employer was probably McDonald's. It's no wonder so many people turned to selling drugs. There just wasn't much legal money to be had. That feeling of hopelessness, of opportunity, always being outside of your grasp can be depressing. I saw it take its toll on a lot of people, including many of my cousins and friends. When my father warned me not to fall into the trap of spending the rest of your life sitting drunk under a tree, he wasn't using it as a metaphor. I would literally see my cousins, guys who as teenagers dressed fly, had game with the ladies and excelled in sports, wasting away their days sitting under a tree for shade, sipping on cheap liquor, and talking about the good old days. Except they weren't even out of their 20s yet, and their dreams were already dead. A guy drinking under a tree in Mount's Corner could just as easily be someone smoking a blunt on a park bench in the Bronx or drinking their lunch in a bar in Houston. A person I describe as under a tree represents anyone who has decided it'll never happen for them, so why even bother trying? Personally, I never in my life thought that my journey was going to end in Mount's Corner. I might have been raised in a small pond, but I was convinced that my hustle and determination were going to make me a fish that was going to swim on to wider waters. Even when I was really fucking up, I always believed that there was something greater out there for me. And how did I know that? How was I sure of it? Because all the incredible books I was reading and inspirational music I was listening to told me so. The beauty of books. If I've had any advantage in this life, it's that I was encouraged to read. From an early age, my mother always made sure she had a book in my face. One of the first ones I remember her giving me was from the Jehovah's Witnesses Watchtower publications called My Book of Bible Stories. I read those tales over and over again. Around the same time I started reading Watchtowers, my mother made another great move by enrolling me in the Book It program at my school, Whitesville Elementary. The program was sponsored by Pizza Hut, and the idea was every time you read four books, you would get a free personal pan pizza. Recently, I read a study that claimed this program didn't actually increase or decrease a person's motivation for reading. I would like to take this opportunity to tell whoever wrote that study to please shut the fuck up forever. I can promise you that the Book It program motivated the hell out of me when it came to reading. Maybe I was predisposed because I looked like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, but I used to love Pizza Hut. Nothing was more exciting than going to Pizza Hut on a Friday night, showing them my reading certificate, and being rewarded with a personal pan pizza. Another savvy thing my mother did was encourage me to read books about people I didn't seem to have anything in common with. Not that there were a ton of books about little black boys growing up in the rural South anyway that weren't about slaves. She wanted books to help introduce me to worlds that might otherwise seem foreign. As a result, I read a lot of Judy Blume and Beverly Cleary. I read so many of them that after a while I started believing that I knew everything about women, especially little girls. To this day, I still think about how if Ramona Quimby had grown up in this era, they would have loaded her up on Ritalin and killed all her creativity and imagination. My mother might have had me reading books about little white girls, but my father was giving me a super black reading list. From an early age, he'd been exposing me to books like The Autobiography of Malcolm X or Message to the Black Man in America by Elijah Muhammad. At first, I wasn't interested. But as I got a little older, a force came into my life that made me want to pick up all those books my father had been recommending. That made me believe that instead of being a fish stuck in a small pond, I was actually a god in control of my own universe. That force was hip-hop. The microphone fiend. As a kid, R&B was the dominant music heard in our home. My mother loved the Supremes. She still plays them for my daughter today. While my father was into soul and funk, especially James Brown. The godfather of soul was born in Barnwell, South Carolina, and I think my father always felt a connection with him because of that. My dad used to have this black Datsun pickup truck, and he would drive around Mount's Corner playing song after song of James Brown. From the old stuff like Cold Sweat and Say It Loud, to the funky shit like Doing It to Death and I'm a Greedy Man. My father loved every groove James ever recorded. He even managed to crash James' funeral in Augusta, Georgia, talking his way onto the stage by acting like he was a part of the family. In a way, he was. The same way my father couldn't get enough James Brown, I developed a similar love affair with hip-hop. Like all true hip-hop junkies, I can still clearly remember the time I got my first hit. I was with my cousin Tyrone McKelvey at my Uncle Harris and Aunt Lottie's house when Tyrone announced, "I got a new song I'm gonna let you hear." As if he was about to let me in on a big secret. He stuck in the tape, and soon I was transfixed by a bass line that felt like it was reaching out of the speakers and punching me in the chest. Then came a deep voice that was at once both harder and slicker than anything I'd ever heard before. Thinking of a master plan, because ain't nothing but sweat inside my hand. When I heard Rakim spit those opening lines, it was like a whole new world had opened up before me. The song sampled the soul sound of my father's generation. Don't look any further from the Temptations' Dennis Edwards Rakim's voice sounded like it was speaking directly to me. He was describing a struggle I was already seeing around me. Not enough money to buy groceries or pay the rent. But in a way, that sounded empowering. Rakim might have only had sweat inside his hand, but his voice was so self-assured and intelligent that you just knew it was only a matter of time before he got his hands on some money again. In fact, the song was called Paid in Full. He wasn't just going to get paid. He was going to get paid in full. In those 3 minutes, my life was transformed forever. From that moment on, I was all in on this hip-hop thing, soaking up every single. Remember those? Cassette and CD I could get my hands on. In the early 90s, that meant listening to a lot of New York legends like Biggie, Nas, Wu-Tang, and my personal favorites, Mobb Deep. Studying their lyrics, I began to notice references to places that I'd never heard of before. What is this Queensbridge Nas speaks of, I'd ask myself. I don't know it, but if it birthed Nas, it must be popping. Wu-Tang kept referencing a Shaolin. Is that where all the gods go to build, I wondered? And Biggie kept talking about BK. I didn't know if it was Burger King or some other place, but if he was referencing it, I wanted to check it out. I had the same reaction to Outkast and Goody Mob rapping about Atlanta or Tupac shouting out L.A. I'd never set foot in California, but to live and die in L.A. described the city with so much energy that Pac made me feel I'd been there. When I did make it to L.A. for the first time years later, thanks to Tupac, I hit the ground with the confidence of someone who'd grown up in South Central. My crew and I loved those songs so much that eventually we started naming spots around Mount's Corner after the places we'd hear shouted out. Highway 6, the notorious drug corridor, became Shaolin after Wu-Tang's nickname for Staten Island. The neighborhood of Whitesville became Brownsville after MOP's Brooklyn Stomping Grounds. A house where we sold dope became Queensbridge after the home of Nas and Mobb Deep. A lot of folks in the media at the time were calling hip-hop a cancer, a negative influence on African-American youth. They said it promoted violence and was misogynistic. They may have been right, but it was having a different influence on me. The truth was that hip-hop wasn't just helping me come up with corny nicknames for places around Mount's Corner. It was sparking my interest in history. It was whetting my appetite for knowledge, definitely more than it was being sparked in school. As I pored over the lyrics of groups like Public Enemy or Wu-Tang Clan, the messages of black consciousness my father had been pushing on me started to feel more relevant. When I heard Chuck D say, "Farrakhan's a prophet and I think you ought to listen to him," or Biggie say that he was deep like the mind of Farrakhan, the dots begin to connect. Thanks to hip-hop, I started devouring books off my father's reading list. Books like Message to the Black Man in America, which exposed systemic racism, and Akil's From Niggas to God, which expanded on the 5% of teachings I'd heard referenced in many songs. The Seed of the Soul by Gary Zukav and the 48 Laws of Power. Robert Greene's classic that was quoted by so many rappers also helped me become more strategic in my thinking. People don't realize how a man's whole life can be changed by one book, Malcolm X. The combined effect of these books and music on my mentality was extremely powerful. Imagine me as a teenager. I'm lying on my bed in our trailer late at night. Occasionally, I'll hear a car kicking up pebbles as it drives down our dirt road. The only other sounds are crickets and bullfrogs outside my window. I'm truly stuck out in the middle of nowhere, a million miles away from where the action is. But in my busted CD Walkman, a piece of tape holding down the battery hatch, a whole other world is forming. Wu-Tang Clan's Cream starts to play softly through the headphones, just loud enough that I can hear it without waking up my mom in the next room. Leave it up to me while I be living proof to kick the truth to the young black youth. But shorty's running wild, smoking cess, drinking beer, and ain't trying to hear what I'm kicking in his ear. As Inspector Deck spits those rhymes over a relentless, driving RZA production, my mind is far away from the cornfields, dirt roads, and swamps outside my window. Nope. I'm weaving through the streets of New York City in a kitted-out Jeep, flying past bodegas and housing projects. Instead of a small-town country boy, I feel like a rap superhero, capable of leaping over my small pond in a single bound and landing wherever I damn well please. That's the confidence I always got from hip-hop. When Rakim said he was born to be the sole controller of the universe, besides the part of the map I hit first, that power came through the speakers and went directly into my soul. Yes, the map might say I was stuck in Mount's Corner for now, but my home was about to be the cosmos. With hip-hop and books empowering me, the excuse I'm from this small-ass town simply wasn't going to be a good enough reason for me not to make it. I'd learned that from Malcolm X to Method Man, from Louis Farrakhan to the Notorious B.I.G., so many of my heroes had grown up in circumstances as bad, if not worse, than mine. If you let society tell it, none of them should have achieved what they did. But they had made it. They had become legends because someone had planted the seed in their minds that they were bigger than whatever environment could have easily held them down, just like they had instilled that sense of confidence in me. Which is why I have to say thank you to Rakim for planting the seed in my mind that it ain't where you're from physically, but where you're at mentally that allows someone to transcend their circumstances. And then thank you to the Wu-Tangs, the Mobb Deeps, and the Nas's of the world for watering that seed until it blossomed into a confident young man who was determined to transcend whatever barriers life seemed to have put in front of him. Beyond your zone. In order to chase your dreams to their end, you must be very focused on getting inspiration where it's available. Take books. Just by the fact that you're reading these pages, you obviously respect the value of the written word. Make sure, however, that you continue to explore books that don't seem to directly connect with your experience. If you're a young black woman, read up on some of the experiences of Asian men. If you're a white guy, pick up a book about the struggle of black women or the immigrant experience. If you're into sports, read a book about science. Or if you mainly read self-help books, check out a historical novel. As I learned from my mother, there's incredible power in subjects that don't seem to pertain to you. One of the best books I read recently is Gary Vaynerchuk's Jab, 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 Right Hook, a guide to how to get your story across on social media. On the surface, I wouldn't seem to have that much in common with Gary. He was born in Russia and as a kid moved to New Jersey, where his parents opened a liquor store. He did poorly in school. Okay, maybe we do have something in common. And spent most of his time helping out around their shop of selling baseball cards. After college, he took over the family business and through a combination of social media savvy, aggressive pricing, and all-around hustle, transformed it from a $3 million to $50 million business in just over 5 years. Gary doesn't look like me. He didn't grow up in a trailer. He wasn't raised in the same religion as me. Hell, he didn't even start off speaking the same language as me. But his story still spoke directly to me. It motivated the shit out of me to keep hustling every day. And when I interviewed him on The Breakfast Club and my podcast, The Brilliant Idiots, a lot of people said they were some of our most motivational episodes ever. Exploring people and ideas outside your comfort zone is one area where hip-hop has been, unfortunately, very weak. As a culture, we don't allow ourselves a chance to grow. If something doesn't look like us or sound like us, we have a tendency to dismiss it out of hand. I grew up as black as you can get. You ain't getting any blacker than Larry McKelvey, son. But I still refuse to have a limited cultural experience. If something seems authentic and interesting, I'm going to check it out. Whether on the surface it appears to be hip-hop or not. I'm never going to dismiss anything until I explore whether it might have some value for me. One year I was at the iHeartRadio Music Awards and they had a tribute to Freddie Mercury and Queen, who I admittedly didn't know that much about. When I saw them on stage playing Another One Bites the Dust, I said, oh shit, these guys were white? Another One Bites the Dust used to have the zebra rocking, so I assumed they were black. My dad, Mr. Black Power, probably knew they were white, but that didn't stop him from playing them in his club. If a song rocks, it rocks. Just as if a book is interesting, it's interesting. Never stunt your own growth by dismissing something just because it doesn't feel familiar. The holy ground of Walmart. Another mistake people with small pond mindsets make is not being motivated by the success stories taking place right in front of them. I've always had the opposite mentality. Growing up, I looked for every possible connection between myself and someone successful, no matter how tenuous the link might seem. I'll never forget flipping through the TV one afternoon after school and landing on BET's Rap City. The host, Big Tigger, was introducing DJ B-Lord as a guest on the show. Live from North Carolina is B-Lord.